A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been reading Bronnie Ware's book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, and the regret that really lodged in him was the number one. I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. He's asking what Ware actually observed about this, and the harder question, how do you actually live your most authentic life while there's still time to do something about it?
This is one of those topics where the surface reading is almost too easy to nod along with and then file away. Live authentically. Sure, great, everyone agrees. But Ware's data from the bedside suggests almost nobody actually does it. And the gap between agreeing with the idea and executing on it is where entire lives get spent.
That's the thing that hits me about this. It's not that people don't know what they want, it's that they know and still don't act. That's a courage problem, not a knowledge problem.
And Ware was in a unique position to see this. She spent 8 years as a palliative care nurse in Australia, working with patients who were in their last 3 to 12 weeks of life. These weren't abstract philosophical conversations. These were people looking at the closing credits of their existence, and Ware was the person in the room with them, often for hours at a time, just listening. She started documenting what she heard on a blog called Inspiration and Chai, which eventually became the book in 2011. It's sold over 1 million copies worldwide since then.
1 million copies of a book about deathbed regrets. That's a lot of people who sensed there was something they needed to hear before it was too late.
Here's the structure of what she found. She synthesized 5 major regrets from hundreds of conversations. Number 5 was, I wish I had let myself be happier. Number 4, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. 3, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. 2, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And number 1, the one that dwarfed all the others, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me.
Every single patient?
Ware says nearly every male patient she cared for expressed some version of this. Women expressed it slightly less frequently, but it was still the dominant theme across the board. And the way she describes it, it wasn't a wistful, oh, maybe I should have taken that painting class. It was a deep, structural recognition that they had built their entire lives on a foundation of other people's expectations, and they were only realizing it when the building was about to be demolished.
That's the raw data from the bedside. But to understand why this regret is so universal, we need to look at who Bronnie Ware actually is and what she observed in the room.
Ware wasn't a psychologist or an academic. She was a palliative caregiver, which in some ways makes her observations more credible, not less. She was doing the emotional labor of sitting with dying people, and she noticed patterns because she was paying attention. She writes about a man who had spent his entire career as a doctor because his father wanted him to be a doctor. And at age 75, in his final months, he started writing poetry. He'd wanted to be a poet his whole life. He spent his last weeks writing verses for the nursing staff. That was his authentic life, compressed into a few months at the end.
75 years of deferred authenticity, and then a sprint at the finish line. The poetry was probably better for having marinated that long, but still, what a waste of all those decades.
That's the paradox Ware kept encountering. Most people, on some level, know what they truly want. The gap isn't knowledge, it's courage. She writes that people half-lived until it was too late, settling for safety and approval over authenticity. They chose the known discomfort of inauthenticity over the unknown risk of being themselves.
This is where I want to push past the inspirational quote version of this and get into the actual machinery. If nearly everyone knows they're living someone else's life, why don't they stop? What's the psychological architecture that keeps intelligent, self-aware people trapped in expectations that aren't theirs?
The answer lives in what I'd call the expectation cascade. And it starts with something deeply wired into us, a social survival instinct. Our brains evolved in environments where group belonging wasn't optional. If you got ostracized from the tribe, you died. The neural circuitry that monitors social approval and disapproval is ancient, and it doesn't care that modern society has removed the physical threat of exile. the machinery still treats social rejection as a survival-level emergency.
When someone considers telling their parents they don't want to be a lawyer, their brain processes it with the same alarm system that used to mean you're about to be left for the wolves.
And the expectation cascade exploits this. It starts small. A parent's career suggestion, a teacher's comment about what you're good at, a cultural script about what success looks like. That becomes a college major. Which becomes a first job? Which becomes a professional identity? Which becomes a mortgage, a lifestyle, a social circle that all reinforce the original choice? By age 40, the original expectation is buried under 20 years of sunk cost, identity investment, and social reinforcement. You're not just a lawyer, you're the person everyone knows as a lawyer. Your spouse married a lawyer. Your kids tell their friends their dad's a lawyer. Untangling that isn't just a career change, it's an identity demolition.
That's the sunk cost fallacy, doing heavy lifting. People stay in inauthentic lives because they've already invested decades. Wes' patients realized at the end that the sunk cost was completely irrelevant. But by then, the investment was all spent anyway.
Behavioral economics has a name for this, but Ware saw it in human terms. The patients who expressed this regret weren't saying, "I made a bad calculation." They were saying, "I knew it was wrong, and I kept going because stopping felt more terrifying than continuing." The terror of disappointing their parents, or their spouse, or their peer group, or even just the version of themselves they'd constructed, that terror was more immediate than the distant, abstract regret of an unlived life.
Until the distant, abstract regret became the only thing left in the room.
There's a concept from developmental psychology that maps almost perfectly onto what Ware observed. James Marcia, in 1966, developed identity status theory. He identified four states: identity diffusion, where you haven't explored or committed to anything; foreclosure, where you've committed without exploration; you've adopted an identity handed to you; moratorium, where you're actively exploring without commitment; and achievement, where you've explored and then committed authentically.
Foreclosure is the diagnosis for most of Ware's patients.
They foreclosed on their own lives. They adopted the identity their family, culture, or peer group handed them, and they never entered the moratorium phase, the period of genuine exploration and questioning. And here's what's brutal about foreclosure. From the outside, it looks like success. The foreclosed person has a clear identity, clear goals, clear direction. They're the ones who have it together. But it's a borrowed coherence. It's not theirs.
That's a devastating phrase. It looks solid until someone asks whose life it actually is.
Ware was the person asking that question, at the worst possible time to hear the answer.
Let's talk about why this is even harder now than when Ware was doing her work. She published in 2011, and the landscape of expectation has only gotten more sophisticated since then. Social media didn't invent performative identity, but it industrialized it.
In 2011, the expectation cascade was mostly driven by family, culture, and immediate peer groups. Now you've got algorithmic feeds showing you curated versions of what success looks like for people you've never met. Career paths get optimized by LinkedIn. Life milestones get compared on Instagram. There's an entire infrastructure dedicated to telling you what you should want, and it's personalized to your demographic, your browsing history, your social graph.
The algorithm doesn't know you, but it knows what people like you are supposed to want, and it's very good at making that look like your own idea.
Which makes the distinction between a genuine personal value and an internalized expectation harder than ever. Ware's patients at least knew the expectations came from their parents or their community. Now the expectations are ambient. They're in the air, they feel like common sense, they're what everyone wants.
How do you even start to separate the signal from the noise? If the expectations are this pervasive, how do you know which desires are actually yours?
I think there are a couple of diagnostic questions. One is the who benefits test. When you imagine succeeding at this goal, getting the promotion, buying the house, hitting the milestone, who's proud of you? If the first faces that come to mind are your parents, or your peer group, or your social media audience, that's a flag. Not necessarily a disqualifier, but a flag. If the first satisfaction is internal, "I did this because it mattered to me," that's a different signal.
The other test is the subtraction test. If nobody ever knew you'd achieve this thing, if there were no LinkedIn posts, no family bragging rights, no social credit whatsoever, would you still want it? If the answer is no, you don't want the thing. You want the approval the thing buys.
That's a ruthless filter. I suspect most people would find it uncomfortable to apply honestly.
Discomfort is the point. If the filter doesn't hurt a little, you're not using it right.
And this connects to something psychologists call the authenticity tax. Michael Kernis and Brian Goldman did research showing that authentic living correlates with higher self-esteem, greater life satisfaction, and better relationships. But it also comes with real social costs. Disapproval from people who preferred the inauthentic version of you. Conflict with family members who thought they knew what you should be. Uncertainty about whether the new direction will work out. Where's patients regretted not paying that tax earlier? They realize the cost of authenticity is front-loaded. It's paid in awkward conversations and temporary disapproval. The cost of inauthenticity is backloaded. It's paid in decades of quiet dissatisfaction, and then in the crushing clarity of a hospital bed.
Front-loaded pain versus backloaded regret. Most people choose the wrong payment plan.
There's a 2023 study in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology that quantified part of this trade-off. Researchers found that people who expressed authentic preferences in group settings were perceived as less warm, but more competent. So authenticity changes how people see you. It makes you slightly less likable in the immediate superficial sense, but more respected in the substantive sense. The study basically confirmed that there's a real social penalty for authenticity, but it's not the penalty most people fear. You're not rejected, you're just seen as more formidable.
Less warm, more competent. That's a trade I'd make every time. Warm is often just code for agreeable enough not to threaten anyone.
That's exactly what Ware's patients had been doing, performing agreeableness at the expense of their own lives. They'd optimized for warmth and woke up at the end realizing nobody was keeping score but them, and their score was zero.
Understanding the trap is one thing. Getting out of it is another. Let's build a practical framework for this, something someone could actually use starting tomorrow.
I've been thinking about this as what I'd call courage calibration, a four-stage model for building authenticity as a skill rather than treating it as a one-time epiphany. Stage one is awareness. This is the diagnostic phase. You need to identify which expectations you're carrying that aren't actually yours. And the most concrete way to do this is what I'd call an expectation audit.
Walk me through it.
Take the five biggest decisions in your life, career, relationship, where you live, major lifestyle choices, significant financial commitments. For each one, ask a single question. Whose expectation was I meeting when I made this choice? Not was this a good decision, or do I like the outcome? Specifically, whose voice was in my head when I committed to this path? If the answer is your father, or your culture, or your peer group, or the version of yourself you thought you were supposed to be, you've identified a candidate for recalibration.
The hard part here is being honest about the answer. Most people have gotten very good at retroactively claiming their choices as their own. I wanted to go to law school. Or did you want to be the kind of person who goes to law school?
That's the distinction. And the awareness phase doesn't require you to change anything yet. It just requires you to stop lying to yourself about whose expectations are steering the ship. Ware's patients got this clarity at the end because death is the ultimate honesty drug. There's no one left to impress. The expectation audit is an attempt to access some of that clarity before the deadline.
Stage one is just looking at the ledger.
Stage two is experimentation. This is where you build authenticity muscles through low-stakes practice. The problem most people have with authenticity is they treat it as a binary. Either you blow up your life to pursue your dream of being a poet, or you stay in the cage. But authenticity is a gradient, and you can practice it in microdoses. Say no to a social obligation you don't actually want to attend. Order the food you actually want instead of what the group is ordering. Voice an unpopular opinion in a low-stakes setting. Wear something you like that isn't fashionable.
One small act per day that aligns with your actual preferences instead of the group's.
And the reason this works is that it trains your nervous system. Remember, the social survival instinct is treating authenticity as dangerous. Every time you express a genuine preference and the world doesn't end, you're recalibrating that threat response. You're teaching your brain that disapproval isn't fatal.
The stakes are so low that the fear is manageable. You're not quitting your job to become a poet. You're just ordering the pasta instead of the salad because the group ordered salad.
Those small acts compound. They build a track record of survival. After 100 micro-authentic choices where nothing bad happened, the brain starts to update its model. authenticity stops feeling like a life-threatening risk and starts feeling like Tuesday. Stage 3 is integration. This is where you start aligning major life decisions with the values you've identified as genuinely yours. The career pivot, the relationship conversation, the geographic move, the creative pursuit. This stage is scary because the stakes are real, but it's supported by the awareness from stage 1 and the confidence from stage 2. You're not leaping blind, you're acting on data you've gathered about yourself.
This is where the authenticity tax becomes a real line item. You're going to have conversations that disappoint people. You're going to make choices that confuse your social circle. The front-loaded cost is due.
And this is where Ware's insight about courage becomes operational. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the willingness to act despite fear because you've decided the alternative is worse. The patients who expressed this regret weren't braver than anyone else. They just ran out of time to be afraid. The fear didn't disappear. It was outlasted by something more urgent. Stage 4 is maintenance, building systems that prevent backsliding. Because the expectation cascade doesn't stop just because you've had one authentic breakthrough. The algorithms are still running. The family dynamics are still there. The cultural scripts haven't changed. You need regular practices that keep you honest. A quarterly expectation audit, a trusted friend who calls you out when you're slipping into performance mode, a journaling practice that surfaces when you're making choices from obligation rather than desire.
It's not a one-time conversion. It's a practice.
Authenticity is a practice, not a destination. Ware's patients didn't regret that they hadn't achieved perfect authenticity. They regretted that they'd never even started. They'd never made a single choice that was truly, unambiguously theirs. The goal isn't a flawless, authentic life. It's a life where you made the choices, not your circumstances or your parents or your peer group. Even if some of those choices turn out wrong, they're yours. And that turns out to be the thing that matters at the end.
There's something important here about the misconception that authenticity means selfishness. Ware's patients weren't regretting that they hadn't abandoned their families to pursue hedonism. They were regretting that they hadn't been honest about who they were, within the context of their responsibilities. Authenticity often means better relationships, not worse ones, because you're actually present as yourself instead of as a performance.
Ware is very clear about this. The patients who expressed this regret weren't saying, "I wish I'd been more selfish." They were saying, "I wish I'd had the courage to be honest." And honesty in relationships, real honesty about what you want, what you feel, what you value, that's not selfishness. It's the foundation of genuine connection. The inauthentic version of you isn't actually protecting your relationships. It's just protecting you from the discomfort of being seen.
The inauthentic version of you isn't protecting your relationships. It's protecting you from the discomfort of being seen. That's the line of the episode right there.
I'll take it. And it connects to another misconception, the idea that you need to know exactly what you want before you can live authentically. Ware's patients didn't all have a clear alternate life plan. Many of them just knew that the life they'd lived wasn't theirs. Authenticity often starts with negation, eliminating what you know you don't want. You don't need to know you want to be a poet. You just need to know you don't want to be a doctor because your father wanted a doctor in the family. The positive vision can emerge later.
That's actually freeing. You don't need a fully articulated alternative. You just need to stop doing the thing that isn't yours.
Ware saw this in real time. Even in their final weeks, patients who made small, authentic choices, writing the poetry, saying the thing they'd never said, reconnecting with a part of themselves they'd buried, found meaning in those acts. It wasn't too late for meaning. It was too late for a different life, but not too late for authenticity.
That's both hopeful and devastating. Hopeful because it's never impossible to start. Devastating because most people wait until the starting line is also the finish line.
Which brings us to what I think is the most practically useful tool from all of this. Borrowing from decision science and from Ware's observations, there's an exercise I'd call the regret reversal. You imagine your 80-year-old self looking back at your current life. Not your deathbed self. That's too abstract, too dramatic. Just your 80-year-old self sitting in a chair reflecting. And you ask, what would that version of me regret not doing? What would they thank me for having the courage to do?
The signal through the noise is that the answers are almost never work more or make more money.
Ware's patients consistently pointed to the same things. Time with people they loved, creative expression they'd suppressed, risks they didn't take, honest conversations they avoided. Not one of them said, "I wish I'd optimized my portfolio more aggressively." The 80-year-old self-heuristic cuts through the daily noise and surfaces what actually matters, and the key is to use it as a decision filter before major choices. Before any significant commitment, ask, "Will my 80-year-old self thank me for this or resent me?"
It's a way of borrowing clarity from a version of yourself that isn't afraid of the same things you're afraid of. Your 80-year-old self doesn't care about the awkward conversation. They care about whether you lived your life or someone else's.
There's a connection here to the Japanese concept of ikigai, which is often misunderstood in Western self-help as just find your passion. Ikigai is the intersection of what you love, what you're good at, what the world needs, and what you can be paid for. It's not just about self-fulfillment. It's about aligning your contribution with your actual self. Authenticity doesn't mean withdrawing from the world to pursue pure self-expression. It means finding the place where your genuine self meets the world's genuine needs.
It's not authenticity versus responsibility. It's authenticity as the foundation for meaningful contribution. You can't serve the world effectively as someone else.
That's the reframe that I think makes this actionable rather than just poignant. Ware's patients weren't advocating for irresponsibility. They were mourning the fact that they'd never found out what their actual contribution could have been, because they'd been too busy fulfilling a script written by someone else.
All of this is useless if it stays abstract. So, let's make it concrete. 3 things someone can do this week.
First, the micro-authenticity practice. 1 small act per day that aligns with your true preferences, even when it's mildly socially inconvenient. Order the food you actually want. Say no to the event you are going to attend out of obligation. Speak up about the movie you actually liked that everyone else is mocking. The content barely matters. What matters is training the muscle.
The key here is that these are low stakes enough that the fear is manageable, but real enough that your brain registers the authenticity. You're not just thinking about being authentic, you're practicing it.
Second, conduct the expectation audit. This week, sit down and write out the 5 biggest decisions in your life. Career, relationship, location, major commitments. For each one, write down whose expectation was in the driver's seat. Be brutally honest. This is for you, not for anyone else. For any decision that was primarily driven by someone else's expectation, write 1 sentence about what you would have chosen if the expectation weren't a factor.
The third one?
Use the 80-year-old self-heuristic as a decision filter. Before your next significant choice, even a medium-sized one, pause and ask, "Will my 80-year-old self thank me for this or resent me?" If the answer is resentment, you've got your signal. The challenge is acting on it before the signal becomes a scream.
The meta-lesson underneath all of this, the thing Ware's patients were really teaching, is that regret isn't about failure. It's about never trying. The goal isn't a perfect, authentic life. It's a life where you made the choices, even the wrong ones. Especially the wrong ones, because they were yours.
Failures you chose are infinitely more satisfying than successes that were chosen for you. Ware's patients didn't regret their failures. They regretted the risks they never took, the words they never said, the self they never revealed. The failure wasn't the problem. The silence was.
One last question, then. If you knew you had 1 year to live, what would you stop doing tomorrow? That's your authenticity signal. The challenge is acting on it before the deadline is real.
That's the open question I'd leave listeners with. Not as a morbid thought experiment, but as a practical filter. What are you doing right now that your dying self would tell you to drop immediately? What conversation are you avoiding? What preference are you suppressing? What version of yourself are you keeping in a box because it's easier to be the version everyone expects?
The difficulty of this only increases, by the way. As AI gets better at predicting and shaping our preferences, algorithmic career recommendations, AI-generated life plans, social media feeds that optimize for engagement by showing us what we're supposed to want. The skill of distinguishing your own voice from the noise is going to become more critical, not less. The expectations are getting smarter. The cascade is getting more sophisticated.
The antidote is the same thing it's always been. Ask the uncomfortable questions. Practice being yourself in small ways until it stops feeling dangerous. And don't wait until the final weeks to write your first poem.
The last thing Ware's patience taught us is that regret is a signal, not a sentence. The question is whether we're willing to listen before the signal becomes a scream. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, Roman provincial road maintenance in what is now Equatorial Guinea required an annual labor contribution from every able-bodied male citizen, equivalent to approximately 1.7 miles of road resurfacing per person, a distance that, if converted to modern marathon terms, would mean each citizen effectively ran a marathon every year just in road labor.
All right. Right. This has been my weird prompts. If you've got a question that's been keeping you up at night, or a book that rearranged your thinking, send it to us at My Weird Prompts. We take your weirdest prompts and turn them into something you can actually use. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go make one choice this week that's actually yours.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.